This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Rich Moore is a mountain biker here in Chattanooga. On YouTube, he's known as Semi-Cindy.
I wasn't looking to win any cross-country races, but rather, I wanted a light and efficient bike that still liked to party. Something with all-day efficiency and comfort that could still stay composed when tackling more technical trails at speed.
Where he takes you on his mountain biking adventures. Rich, thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
You grew up in the Roanoke, Virginia area. When you were 8 years old, you picked up cycling.
I did. I guess that was when I got my first mountain bike. I started riding a bike at a younger age. It was on training wheels. And then I don't know what age I was when we took the training wheels off. My dad thinks maybe sometime around 5 or 6. So I'm 41. And this would be in the 80s. My first quote-unquote mountain bike was a Schwinn Frontier, and it was just a steel bike with no suspension on it, and it was actually referred to as an ATB, an all-terrain bicycle at the time, but it was an early version of what mountain bikes were. At the time, that's what mountain bikes were. And I lived up on a mountain right off the Blue Ridge Parkway, and my neighbors down the street, the woods behind their house had a connector trail that connected over to a series of trails off the Blue Ridge Parkway. At this point in time, though, in the 80s, mountain biking wasn't really recognized much by municipalities. And so the legalities of riding mountain bikes were all gray area. There were no motorized vehicle signs. But other than that, there was really nothing stating much of anything. And there were just hiking trails. So if you wanted to ride your bike on trails, you just kind of had to find some trails and try to ride them and see how things went. Luckily, the rangers up there were pretty cool about it. And we were all kids, you know, at the time. And I think they were just kind of thought it was neat seeing us out riding through the trails back there and back in the campground area and whatnot. And as time went on, we reached out to some further, you know, some outlying areas outside of town, and particularly a place called Carbon's Cove, which is now a really popular mountain bike trail system just outside of Roanoke. But at the time, it wasn't. The trails existed, and mountain biking wasn't actually legal there until, I don't know, a decade or two ago.
And you brought your passion for mountain biking when you came to this area.
I did. Yeah. I moved here 5 years ago. Lived in a lot of different places after, once I graduated high school, I left Roanoke and lived in various different parts of the country. And previous to here, I lived in Asheville, North Carolina for a good long time, and then came here 5 years ago, and I love it. Chattanooga is awesome.
And plenty of opportunities to experience it on a mountain bike over and over again.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And Chattanooga itself is just, if you're into outdoor activities, it is just perfect because you have hiking, mountain biking, of course, rock climbing, whitewater kayaking, or even flat water, stand-up paddle boarding, recreational boating, everything you can imagine under the sun is right here in town and right at pretty much at our doorsteps. You know, a lot of people think of Asheville, North Carolina as being this great outdoor city, and it is in a really incredible part of the world, but it's a minimal 45-minute drive to get into the true outdoors or wilderness areas. And here, that's not the case. In 5 minutes, I can be at a trailhead and feel like I'm completely outside of the city, which is unbelievable. It's, I think, the best kept secret in the Southeast for outdoor recreation. It's not so much a secret, but, you know.
Well, people such as you who are outdoors enthusiasts, you all have that in common. You all say something like what you just said.
We're lucky. Good people here too. The people really make Chattanooga a special place. It feels like I've been here so much longer than 5 years.
When did you decide to pick up a camera and film what you do?
Well, as far as specifically what I'm doing now, I didn't decide that until a year ago. I have a film company. I do documentaries, commercial advertising, et cetera, things of that nature through that film company. I got into photography at a very young age. And so this has kind of just been a progression to get here to this point.
And your dad is an amateur photographer.
Yes. You know, I first got interested in photography just from him. And he had a a Nikon film camera. I'm trying to remember what body camera he had. It was really nice old film camera. And I was always super intrigued by it. I remember sneaking into the room that he kept it in and the drawer that he kept it in. I would just open the drawer and look at the camera. I don't know why. I have no idea why I was so fascinated with it, but I guess it was something I was just drawn to.
What is it like to film what you're doing? Because you're having to coordinate both of those things at once. You might have help, but still, it's another layer of challenge.
Yeah, it's interesting. And in fact, right now, 99% of, you know, any of the camera work, et cetera, I'm doing it myself. I just don't have the budget yet to hire anybody to help with that. Not for this aspect of things. So it'd be nice if it gets to that point at some time to make things a lot easier. It could be some long days out filming for sure. Setting up camera angles and whatnot. It's a lot of work.
How much do you have to stage cameras along where you ride versus wearing a camera versus mounting a camera on what you're riding?
GoPros are kind of the popular thing with outdoor sports and filming and whatnot, and you can get the point of view, POV, so to say. And that's easy. You put the camera on and you go, hit record and start riding. The tricky part are going to be all the third person shots where it's a camera that's physically set up somewhere along the trail to capture a section. And the way that works, I don't just put a whole bunch of cameras out down a trail or anything like that. I just take one. I have a system where I can quickly pack and unpack it. But I go to a section of trail that I think is intriguing and would film well. And I set up different angles and I shoot each angle one by one by one, then put it all together in the editing process afterwards.
And you've done long distance riding. You focus more now on gravity trails and you have started to get into downhill racing, something that you didn't think you'd ever do.
Yeah, you've done your homework. I always was kind of a cross country rider growing up through my teens and 20s. The last decade, like in my 30s, I was still riding cross country long trail rides, mostly out in Pisgah National Forest, but I had a new passion there for a while. It's still one of my passions, but it was whitewater canoeing. And that kind of took precedence for a good bit. And when I moved to Chattanooga, I'd still ride cross country, but more just kind of like tertiary fitness type stuff, cross training type stuff. It really wasn't until Allison got into, she's my girlfriend, she got into mountain biking a couple of years ago and totally fell in love with it. And, you know, of course, it was easy for me to switch gears back into that. And that really, really manifested in a different way this time around. And I never really thought I'd be the type of person to do a lot much gravity riding. And gravity riding specifically typically refers to downhill focused riding where you're not so much generating that much of the speed out of pedal force, but more from just the sheer steepness and speed of the trail and the use of gravity. A lot of times people either shuttle up with big burly bikes to do that, whether that's at a bike park, up a chairlift, or through an actual vehicle shuttle, or maybe they do some shuttling on some trail systems that are public. Shuttling at Raccoon is actually a pretty popular way of riding the trail system there. I wouldn't call that gravity riding because it's still very much earned. Even if you shuttle laps up a Raccoon, you are doing a good bit of pedaling, but you can get a lot more done. You can do a couple shuttles. So it's been really cool to kind of dip my toes into this different aspect of riding. I still trail ride. I still do long distance, cross country trail, backcountry type rides, but this new facet has been really fun to explore. I try to cover everything on the channel though.
And where did the name Semi-Cindy come from?
It's a good question. The name actually was kind of a joke. In the whitewater community, I have a whole bunch of Canadian friends. I'm one of those weird people in the whitewater world that instead of using the logical craft, which is a kayak, I use a canoe and make things more difficult on myself. And so as it turns out, Canadians, their two big pastimes are, you know, hockey and canoeing. And so you have a lot of people in the whitewater community and Canada actually are whitewater canoeists. So or open boaters is another way to refer to that. But the group of friends I have up there, that they're just hilarious. They all have a great sense of humor, easygoing, really fun people to hang out with. And we're very much kind of the sort of crew that loves to just poke fun at ourselves for canoeing. And so we always joked about, you know, why the term being Cindy, you know, being really good at something and going really big and XYZ. We always kind of joked it, like, why be Cindy when you could just, you know, be semi Cindy and have a lot of fun along the way. So when I made the channel, it just kind of, I couldn't really think of anything. And I was like, just be semi Cindy. That keeps the pressure off. Now I don't have to do anything crazy.
I think you nailed the name. Beyond having the experience, beyond sharing the experience with people through the channel, there's some things that you'd like people who watch the channel to take away from it.
I think the things that I want to convey are just to get out there and experience things, try things outside of your comfort zone. A lot of times you can learn a lot about yourself and find some really unique rewards in that process. And to not take yourself too seriously while doing it. Remember that it's all about the experience. It's all about the fun. It's about the camaraderie. It's about the natural world around you. And another piece that'll become more and more of a prominent component of the channel is advocacy. I've always had a soft spot in my heart for advocacy for various different things in the natural world, as far as whether that's getting access to new trails or whether it's just cleanup days, maintenance days, being a good steward in general, but also not just of the environment, but of other people out and about, being a good representation of what mountain bikers are, you know, and respecting other users out there and just, I don't know, in general, just having a good time and sharing the love of it.
And where can people go online to keep up on the channel?
The channel is a YouTube channel. You can type in semi, S-E-M-I dash Cindy, S-E-N-D-Y into the YouTube search and that'll pull it right up. You can also find me on Instagram with the exact same handle. Those are the two best places right now to follow what I'm doing.
All right, Rich, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ray. I appreciate it. It's good to be here.
Mental health professionals in the Chattanooga area have had to meet growing needs throughout the pandemic. Rachel Geringer is the Southeast Regional Director for the Tennessee Suicide Prevention Network. Eve Knight handles business development and community outreach for Erlanger Behavioral Health Hospital. First, we talked about the needs, and then a series of events called Pop-Up for Hope.
And we saw that there was an increase in acuity and an increase in kind of first-time crises, right? So there's not necessarily been an increase in people dying by suicide. There's not necessarily been an increase in people in that sense, but there has been an increase in people having higher level of symptoms than ever before. And what we really understood that to be what's causing that is this increase of stress, multifactorial stress. So lots of different ways that we're being stressed, from isolation to economic hardships, all of those factors is increasing the acuity of people. And really, the best remedy there is for us to reconnect face-to-face, not digitally. We know that digital connection does not light up our brains the same way that in real life connection lights up our brains. And we know that people need hope. We talk about hope as this ethereal thing, but what hope is really a chemical process in your brain that counterbalances your stress response processes in your brain, which we know are a huge factor in mitigating mental illness. So we came up with this pop-up for hope idea. It sounds maybe a little silly, but it was an evidence-based practice for us to intervene in real life, inspire hope, and get people resources in their hands that they could access.
And then tell us more about how this pop-up for hope works.
We have hosted about 12 different pop-up events since the beginning of the pandemic. And we've been through this. We've been in this pandemic for a while, over a year. Basically, we partner with places where we know there are going to be people. Especially during this pandemic, it's sometimes hard to get people to go to a new place. You know, people are really trying to stay at home and limit their exposure and all of that. So we were thinking about, okay, where are people going? And so, you know, we started off partnering with Hamilton County Schools when they were doing the food distribution for their families at different schools. And so we did our first one at one of their schools and had mental health resources. We had therapy horses there. We had therapy dogs. We had a Kona ice truck where people could get free Kona ice. And this is back in the summer. So Kona ice, you know, it was a hot day. So that was really good for people. And it was just an unexpected thing. They didn't know we were going to be there. These families didn't know that, hey, we're going to see horses literally in the lawn of our school. And so it kind of helps a little bit to jar their brains out of, like Eve was saying, the stress brain. And so we're also putting mental health resources directly into the hands of people who may need them. So there's kind of a couple things that we're doing. We also have, again, people in person, in real life, who can connect with folks, check in, see how they're doing. And then these folks, you know, would be able to, if they have any questions or need anything specific to mental health, we can help answer those questions. And then really, we also have fun. We have music and, you know, we have signs with messages of hope and really just try to provide a positive experience for people that, again, they're not expecting. So we've done this in different locations a lot and partner with food insecurity, because right now we know there are people who are more food insecure who have not been in the past. And there's been an increase in folks needing food. So we've done a lot of partnering with those distribution sites who are seeing a lot of people who need resources. And we've also done assisted living facilities. We did a Halloween event at Loopy's Pizza, where we did a pop-up there at a couple of their locations. So we've kind of tried different things. Yeah, it's kind of just an unexpected infusion of hope is really how to describe it.
What's the response that you have received so far?
There's sort of been responses from different people. So first of all, I feel like there's been a response in the people who are actually volunteering to be part of these events. You know, we're all going through and have been going through this pandemic too, just like everyone else. And so, you know, we would hear comments from our volunteers and even have these comments ourselves that, wow, it's just so nice and refreshing to actually talk to people in person. And I think it really helped us figure out and see firsthand what the need is and what people are going through. We were able to talk one-on-one with people. The response from the people that we're interacting with is kind of similar. They would be like, it's really refreshing and nice to be able to actually talk to someone. And a lot of them are kind of surprised that we're there and thankful that we're there and thankful for the resources and all the other little things that we're able to offer in addition to the mental health resources. I think as far as the organizations that we partner with to do these pop-ups, they're also thankful because a lot of them recognize that there are mental health needs too, and they don't know how to address those. So places like schools and churches and places where they're doing food distribution, other social services organizations, they don't necessarily know how to address those mental health needs. So I think it's really relieving to them. And they're very thankful that we're able to kind of step in and be like, hey, we got this. We can help out with this.
And I have to say at the beginning, too, there was a lot of apprehension from sites to partner with us. No, we're limiting the amount of people that can be on site. There was a lot of concern about, can we do this safely without just infecting absolutely everyone? But we followed both the CDC guidelines. We consulted with the clinicians that we knew. We consulted, you know, with all of our risk management in our agencies, and the overarching impression was, yes, we can do these things safely. We still face some apprehension from certain sites. Oh, no, we want to limit volunteers. We don't want to have a bunch of people together. And I think the message needs to be, we can do this safely if we follow the scientific protocols and guidelines that have been laid out for us. We did. We've done 12 of them. We've reached over 5,000 people, I think, was the number, and we've done it completely safely. And what's more is there's a risk that if we don't do these things, people are going to suffer and die. We've got to find a way where we can have both. We can have safety, we can have connection, and we can have real active intervention.
And in the meantime, you're planning ahead for more.
And we've had other communities all across the state actually consult us and say, we're hearing about this. We've actually heard about you guys doing this. How did you do it? Can you coach us through doing it in our own communities? So I believe we've had several in Middle Tennessee that have hosted pop-up events after joining us and some of ours, and we're expanding out into other counties, which is good. It needs to be a thing, not just during a pandemic. Our lives are going to continue to have stressors for many years to come. We really need this kind of community involvement always.
One thing that I've heard a lot during this pandemic is this idea that, well, COVID hit us and now we're not able to do anything, and that we can't do the things that we did before, which is somewhat true. But I really think that these pop-up events that we're doing is an amazing example of how we can really innovate and we can get creative and we can still reach the people that we need to serve that need our help. And we can't use this pandemic has come into our lives as an excuse to do nothing, because, you know, all of us thought, okay, this will be maybe a couple months and then it'll go away. But we've been in this for over a year and there are still needs and there will continue to be needs, and those needs will change. Really just focusing on, okay, there are more needs right now than there have been, and there may continue to be those needs. So we need to continue to innovate ways that we can reach members of our communities.
And for people who want more information about Pop-Up for Hope, if they need help, where can they go online? Where can they call?
If they need mental health crisis services, so if they are in a mental health crisis and they are worried, if they do not get help, there may be some negative outcome. There are some different resources I would recommend. 855-CRISIS-1 is the statewide crisis line, and that will connect them to local mental health crisis resources. There's also something called the crisis text line, which is pretty cool. And I want to make sure everyone knows that this is a resource, since people like to text a little bit more sometimes than call certain people. So they can text the keyword TN to 741741, and it's a 24/7 resource. Someone will respond to you, and it can be anything that you feel like is a crisis they can help with. So it doesn't have to just be related to mental health. It could be other issues as well. And so those are two statewide resources. There are several organizations that are involved in these pop-up events. Tennessee Suicide Prevention Network is one, and our website is tspn.org. There's also CIT Connect.
Yeah, so citconnect.org. That's the crisis intervention team with a partnership through our law enforcement and first responders in the area. And you can actually go to citconnect.org/get-involved, and you'll see the pop-up for hope under our community initiatives. If you'd like to volunteer, if your agency would like to be involved in the pop-up for hope initiative, they can visit that website and fill out the form and get involved.
And another one of our really important partners for these pop-up events is the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Chattanooga. So their website is NAMI, Chattanooga.org. And they actually operate a helpline. So if people are needing mental health support for either themselves or for a loved one, and they need help finding resources, that is something that their helpline can assist with.
All right. Rachel, Eve, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots, talking writing. Our guests are Elliot Ackerman and James Stavridis, the authors of a new novel titled 2034, in which they posit the possibility of a nuclear war between China and the United States. Elliot Ackerman is the author of several novels, most recently Red Dress in Black and White. His books have been nominated for the National Book Award, the Andrew Carnegie Medal in both fiction and nonfiction, and the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, among others. He's both a former White House fellow and a Marine who served 5 tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, where he received the Silver Star, the Bronze Star for Valor, and the Purple Heart. Admiral James Stavridis is retired from the U.S. Navy, having spent more than 30 years rising to the rank of 4-star admiral. He was the Supreme Allied Commander at NATO, and he previously commanded the U.S. Southern Command, overseeing military operations in Latin America. At sea, he commanded a Navy destroyer, a destroyer squadron, and an aircraft carrier battle group in combat. He holds a PhD from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, where he recently served 5 years as dean. He has published 9 previous books and hundreds of articles. He's also a frequent national and international television commentator, as well as a Bloomberg Opinion weekly columnist and a monthly columnist for Time magazine. At the beginning of the novel, it's March 12, 2034, U.S. Navy Commodore Sarah Hunt is on the bridge of her flagship, the guided missile destroyer USS John Paul Jones, conducting a routine freedom of navigation patrol in the South China Sea when her ship detects an unflagged trawler in clear distress with smoke billowing from its bridge. On that same day, U.S. Marine aviator Major Chris Wedge Mitchell is flying an F-35E Lightning over the Strait of Hormuz, testing a new stealth technology as he flies dangerously close to Iranian airspace. By the end of that day, Wedge is an Iranian prisoner, and Sarah Hunt's destroyer is at the bottom of the sea, sunk by the Chinese Navy. Iran and China have clearly coordinated their moves, which involve the use of powerful new forms of cyber weaponry that render U.S. ships and planes effectively defenseless. In a single day, America's faith in its military's strategic preeminence is in tatters, and the potential for nuclear conflict between the U.S. and China is no longer the stuff of nightmares, but is an imminent reality. I'd like to start by asking you, you are both extremely accomplished people. You have both been published widely. Is this the first time you have written together?
This is my 10th book, but my first novel, and the way the collaboration came about, and yes, it is the first time Elliot and I have collaborated on an piece of literature together, but we've known each other close to a decade because we're both graduates of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, where I was the dean, and I asked Elliot to become our writer in residence after he published his first novel, Green on Blue, about Afghanistan. So we've known each other close to a decade. We share our graduate school experience at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, and he is by far the more accomplished novelist. I learned a lot working with him, and it was a real pleasure to collaborate with him.
What do you find is the essential difference between telling a story that is, while it's informed by fact, is fictional, as opposed to writing a piece that is informed by fact and is not fictional?
I loved writing a novel because all my previous 9 books were nonfiction and were, very fact-based, very footnoted, full of references. It's like wearing a straitjacket when you write nonfiction. But when you're writing fiction, you know, you throw off the straitjacket and you can splash a little paint around, so to speak. I like the idea of bringing characters into a story. You know, I could have written a policy book about the dangers of a war with China, but a lot fewer people would have read it. It wouldn't have had any characters in it. And you can't really project into the future in a very definitive way, the way you can in a novel like this.
Well, I have to compliment you both on the characters. They are etched in my imagination. They are very much three-dimensional, whether it's the pilot Wedge, the admiral, the female admiral who smokes a cigar with one of the other, I think the other woman is an admiral also, on the deck of the destroyer. Here they are comparing how good one Cuban cigar is over another. It was an interesting insight into the culture, I assume, that you have both experienced. Is that true, Elliot? You have been a Marine. Are there female Marines?
There most certainly are female Marines, and I think although Jim and I come from different services, we are both serve as naval officers, so there is overlap. And I think particularly with the characters who are Marines or Admiral Sarah Hunt, who you mentioned, we very much wanted to make sure they were steeped in the cultures from which they came. But then there are also cultures we were engaging with these characters who are much farther afield than our own. You know, for instance, Qasem Farshad, who is a brigadier general in the Iranian Quds Force, who spent much of his career fighting in the shadow wars against the United States in places like Iraq, Afghanistan, and also fighting in Syria, or even Admiral Lin Bao, who, when we first meet him, is the Chinese admiral who is the military attaché to the United States. So, throughout this, as you create these characters, both of us, we're drawing from our own experience base, our own knowledge base, but then at the end of the day, also your imagination and what you your vision of the story, as you mentioned, that you know, that cigar, or there's a scene with some M&Ms very early on with Lin Bao, so that the reader can really feel the story and it becomes tangible to them.
It strikes me that all of the principal characters are, in one way or another, you mentioned the Iranian. I think that he probably have a lot of common ground with Wedge, who is an American, a pilot from a family that goes back four generations of flyers. Their attitude to the world and their place in it, there seems to be a lot of commonalities.
Sure, I would definitely agree with that. And sometimes at face value, you might think that a fourth generation American Marine fighter pilot and a at least second generation Iranian officer, you know, couldn't be more diametrically at odds with one another. But obviously, the commonality they have is, you know, they come from these military families. They're individuals who've been defined by conflict. So in many ways, they're, in fact, very, very close to one another. And I think often, you know, in a novel, as you create these characters, you know, you're looking for areas of overlap. You know, the books that I enjoy reading, which are the books that, you know, I also aspire to write, are the types of books where there'll be a character that I will become deeply emotionally invested in, who at face value would seem to have no areas, you know, where I would have an access point to that character, but that the author is able to show me those areas where we are similar and where we have so much in common, and in so doing, really, really surprise.
Yeah, I'd like to compliment you both on creating fully fleshed out three-dimensional characters. I can see those people when I'm reading what they say. It's almost as if their accent is there on the page in my ear, which is really mixing metaphors, sorry. But I'd like to address a question to both of you. At some point toward the end of the novel, you say America is a quote-unquote idea. Do you think all of the players in this war were countries that in the minds of the combatants, so we're talking America, China, Russia, and Iran, in the minds of the combatants representing those four different countries, are the countries an idea in their mind too?
After you, Elliot. One of the things that makes America unique from many, many other countries is that we are not a blood and soil nation, meaning that what defines America, you know, is not an ethnicity, and it isn't even necessarily the boundaries, the geographic boundaries of our country. That many, many number of the people who came here immigrated here, and of those, they came here for an idea, for that American idea. So, for instance, I could go immigrate to China, but as long as I'm alive, I will never be Chinese. Whereas a person from China could come to the United States, and as soon as they take that oath of citizenship, they are American. Now, have we always perfectly executed that idea? Have we always lived up to the ideals of this nation? No, of course we haven't. But this nation was founded in order to form a more perfect union. It doesn't mean that we make the perfect union. We're constantly striving to form a more perfect union. And that's what an ideal is. An ideal is neither true nor false. An ideal is a mark on the wall that we're all trying to reach.
Jim?
I agree with Elliot's assessment, and the only thing I would add to it is that our value system, I think, is actually fairly clear. It's democracy, liberty, two different things, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of education, freedom of assembly, gender equality, racial equality. We execute those values imperfectly, but I think they define us as a nation, and the degree to which America is successful in this century, in my view, will be the degree to which we hew to those values.
While at the same time, the U.S., at least my impression of the U.S. in the book, is a bit like a five-year-old with a machine gun. Well-meaning, naive, not entirely aware of the impact of their strength and their position in the world, which is challenged by a superpower that, you know, just listening to the news today, there's a suggestion that the Chinese might well at some point become aggressors in a war against the United States. After what we've just said about the U.S., in the book you say of China, no one person is ever more than, quote, a single cog in the vast machinery of the People's Republic. And there's the sense, again and again through the book, that the Chinese play the long game, that what might seem to us to be a long time to them is merely a nanosecond in the history of the world and the history of their, I don't know how to describe it. It's not really, it doesn't seem to me that, you know, it, to go back to that idea of America being an idea, it seems in many ways that China is also an idea, a very different idea, but an idea.
Yeah, I think the challenge is that, in my view, China is gradually changing its self-view from what has been the norm for thousands of years, which was the idea of the Middle Kingdom, that they were positioned between heaven and earth, and they didn't, as a result, feel the urgency or the need to conquer. China has not been one to go well beyond its borders. Today in China, you're seeing the rise of nationalism inside China. You're seeing a much more assertive China in terms of operations globally. They have a global strategy called One Belt, One Road, which is mercantile, geoeconomic, geopolitical. They are moving out. That is a change, and it is going to create friction points with a globally engaged United States of America. So in the book, 2034, A Novel of the Next World War, we're trying to lay out the dangers of those friction points turning into a full-blown Cold War in which there are skirmishes, such as we opened the book with, and skirmishes can lead to battles, which happens in the book, and battles can lead to wars. And as I always say, there's no good guys and bad guys in this novel. There's a villain. The villain is war itself. And if we want to avoid a war in 2034, we better figure out how to approach China and how to work with them. And we better also be prepared in case that fails.
I agree with you, Jim, on that assessment. It doesn't feel as if there's a bad guy exactly, although I must say that the Chinese come across as rather coldly calculating. I thought it was kind of interesting that the ultimate referee, if you will, in the ultimate conflict is India.
Elliot.
Do you see India as having the potential to be able to play a role like that, to be a mediator in a conflict between two huge nations? Not that India isn't a huge nation, but in fact, both India and China are bigger than the United States by far, aren't they, in terms of population?
I think what we see is that India has a young population, a growing population, although militarily at this moment it's not necessarily a peer competitor of the United States or China. I think it's worth reflecting on the fact that in 1939, the United States was the 19th largest military in the world. Our military was right behind that of Portugal, and we sure figured out a way to play catch up pretty quickly. So the role of India is certainly central to the book and how events in 2034 take shape, but that intersects with one of the key themes in the book, you know, which is this idea that if you look at the last 100 years, which I think we could certainly characterize as an American century, that century was birthed really in two European conflagrations, right? The First and the Second World War. And those were two wars that the United States did not start, but the United States certainly finished, and finished those wars to great advantage. So 2034, the book opens, and the United States and China have started a war. But obviously, one of the questions the book deals with is who finishes that war, on what terms, and how do they benefit?
Yeah, my impression is that the whole thing starts because the Chinese are smarting at the idea that America seems to feel that it has free license to travel in waters that they consider territorial waters. So they deliberately pick a fight. And the sobering part of the way they pick a fight is a reflection on how much we are dependent on technology.
It certainly is. And it's also, I think, a reflection on one of the fundamental attributes of war. They pick a fight, but it's a miscalculation, because the fight they think they can keep is limited to these stopping one of these freedom navigation patrols in the South China Sea. And it quickly escalates through miscalculations on the parts of both sides. But technology plays a central role in this, particularly cyber, because one of the miscalculations is an American presumption that our advantage in terms of conventional arms, aircraft carriers, advanced fighter technology still exists. And cyber really becomes a leveler in the book. and takes our advantage and really puts us in a peer level fight, because we don't have the same advantage that we think we believe, because the Chinese have been able to disable so much of our technological capacity through cyber.
And what led you to that scenario? What do you see the potential for that?
Yes, I think it is a unfortunately realistic scenario. We can still avoid it. You know, this is the 10 to 15 year future. But if we don't rationally confront the fact that we could drift into a war with China, it becomes more likely that we actually will. So that was a real premise in writing the book, 2034.
Yes, I understand that in the scenario in the book, America is the innocent party, at least in the immediate, looking to offer a helping hand, and that hand is swiftly bitten by an enemy that has set them up. At a point toward the end of the book, you quote Abraham Lincoln, who begins in the quote by saying that America will never be defeated, and goes on to say, if destruction be our lot, we must ourselves be it. Author and its finisher, as a nation of free men, we must live through all time or die by suicide. That quote resonates directly because of the plot in the book, and I don't want to reveal the story, but suffice to say that that quote is very resonant in the events in the book. The notion that, let me direct this to Elliot, Jim, that goes back to that, as you were saying before, that idea of America. That in Lincoln's understanding of it 150 odd years ago, America is an invincible power that will never be colonized by an invader. And yet, in the scenario you present, that's a possibility.
And I think what Lincoln was speaking to, you know, he spoke those words several years before the American Civil War, was that oftentimes we imagine the existential threat being external to us. And obviously, 2034 is a book about a war with China that spreads into a global conflagration. But it's also a book about America, and it's about how America responds to that, and some of the trends inside America that make us susceptible to not being able to unite and confront an external threat. And one of those is obviously the dysfunction and the hyper-partisanship that exists in our politics today. And that very much plays a role in the book. For example, in 2034, in that world we've created, you know, the president of the United States is both a woman, which seems unremarkable to imagine in the year 2034, but maybe more remarkably and more plausibly, though, too, is the idea, or very plausibly, is that she's a political independent, and that our two-party system has become so dysfunctional that she has been able to run and win as an independent. And I think as much as this book is obviously very much a sounding a warning bell about external threats to the United States, obviously China, it's also sounding a warning bell about the nature of political dysfunction that exists in this country, and now that if we can't figure out how to solve those problems at home, we will certainly struggle to unite against an external threat.
I think the notion of a nonpartisan president makes perfect sense. I think in some sense, that's what Joe Biden aspires to be. And to some degree, I guess, so did Barack Obama. Barack Obama, as we all know, didn't succeed. It still remains to be seen whether Joe Biden is going to be able to pull this off. He reminds me in some ways of Lyndon Johnson, a consummate politician, but one who also has his eyes on the prize that will benefit the majority. The divide in the book, it would seem, is perhaps personified by Weizcarver, who is the worst kind of hawk. Even when he's offered the opportunity to diffuse things, he ignores it because he's wanting to be bellicose and be combative. Given your experience in government, both of you, Jim, if you care to answer this, do you think that that is the true partisan divide between those who would gleefully prosecute a war and those who would do all they can to avoid it?
Certainly, historically, that has been a divide. Look at the war in Vietnam. Look at World War I. There were multiple voices who counseled against going into that war. Look at World War II. The United States got into World War II because we were attacked by the Japanese Empire, and then Germany declared war on us.
So there is a rich tradition in the American body politic of disagreement about whether to go into wars or not. My sense of President Biden is that he is less inclined to reach for the military interest, military tool, more inclined to use diplomacy, economics, strategic communication, cultural connection, development, all of those other tools of American power. But I'll observe that those tools, which are sometimes called soft power, to have soft power but not have the means to apply hard power when you need it is no power. And I don't think we want to be there either.
That's an interesting point. The way you're describing America sounds a lot like India in the book.
I think that's a fair comparison, although India is a very different in so many different ways than the United States. But that is a point that India, by the time of this novel and out into this century, I think will have evolved in a number of ways that are going to surprise us.
In the book, you have effectively two bellicose superpowers. The United States, if you will, gets its nose tweaked by the Chinese. And still, there is the sense on the part of many that this is not a time to step up, but rather to step back and diffuse the situation, not approach it mano a mano, while at the same time, there are those who would do just that. It seems to me that one of the theses in the book is that that is the problem, that America is too quick to take offense and to flex muscles when that's not going to solve the problem. You need the muscle, as you said, to back up that soft approach, but the soft approach is always going to be the only answer that's really viable and won't result in the horror of a nuclear war.
Well, I think the book is very much about the dangers of entering into an escalatory cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, wars are fought by people, and human beings are emotional creatures. And look back through history, you cannot underestimate the significant role that emotion and miscalculation play in the prosecution of a war. So, you know, as I said, miscalculation is baked into every war because both sides obviously believe that they're going to win or at least finish the conflict on advantageous terms. And because both sides believe that, one side is obviously incorrect because one side is going to lose. That is the type of scenario we wanted to show. So, yes, that certainly occurs on behalf of the United States and also occurs on behalf of the Chinese because, you know, we're all humans here and all of us are subject to the type of folly that often leads to massive wars.
Well, I have to tell you, toward the end of the book, Slim Pickens came to mind in Dr. Strangelove. Given your experience, both of you, from what you were just saying, Elliot, are these decisions not made dispassionately? Is it your experience that emotion plays a part in decision-making at the highest level of government here in America?
I'll answer briefly, but I'd also really like to turn that over to Jim. But I would say certainly emotion plays a role at the very highest levels of government. And I think that our history definitely bears that out.
Jim, is that your experience, Jim?
Yes. And I've done 6 tours of duty in the Pentagon. I've worked in and around the National Security Council staff. I've worked at State Department. It is always true that human nature plays a significant and an often disproportionate impact in driving events. And therefore, we should never underestimate the chances of miscalculation. You know, I'm fond of quoting that great book of leadership, The Godfather by Mario Puzo, in which the Don says, don't make the mistake of hating your enemies. It clouds your judgment. I think that's very true, not only among the mafioso in New York in the 1960s, but among nations today.
You called your book 2034. 2034 is uncomfortably close. That's less than 15 years away. What would your advice, both of you, be to the leadership of the United States for the next 2 decades?
I think my advice for the national leadership of the United States in dealing with China is, number one, have a plan. Create a strategic plan that uses all the tools of national power collectively and doesn't over-rely on the military plan. Number two, a key element in that strategy should be binding together our allies, partners, and friends, especially in Asia, Japan, South Korea, Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, Vietnam, and many others, but also our NATO and European allies. Bring them together with us not so we can fight China together, but so we can create a balance in the international system. And third, put more focus on technology at the military level, because the best way to avoid a war is to be prepared to fight one effectively. That causes your enemies to stop and think before they launch an attack. That means more investments in cyber, space, hypersonic cruise missiles, nanotechnology, and the like. And fourth and finally, my key advice would be take a lesson from China and try and think more long-term about all of these challenges. China does that very effectively. We are the victims of a lot of short-range tactical thinking. See paragraph one about having a plan. That plan ought to look out over the 50-year, the 100-year future with China.
Thank you so much for your time, Jim. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for the book.
My pleasure talking to you, Richard. I'll let you wrap up with Elliot.
Thank you.
All the best. Bye.
Elliot?
Thank you, Richard. You know, I don't have anything to add to what Jim said. I think that's probably a good way to summarize.
I'm inclined to summarize, at least in part. It seems to me that what he's suggesting, at least in part, is a sort of 21st century version of the nuclear standoff.
Yeah, and I think we just need to continue to invest in these capabilities, to do the hard work of imagining how disastrous any type of direct confrontation with China would be, so that we can avoid it.
So you can approach a volatile situation gently by using strength.
Yes.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you too, Elliot. Thank you so much for the book. To be honest with you, I can't say I entirely enjoyed reading it, because I found the whole premise a little frightening, because it seems so possible and so simple. But the fact that you've put it in print maybe has diffused that notion.
Well, I hope so.
Was that your intent?
It was, yes.
Albert Einstein is often quoted as saying, "I know not with what weapons World War III will be fought, but World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones." After reading this novel, you may well have a renewed appreciation for that insight. The novel, by our guests Elliot Ackerman and James Stavridis, titled 2034, has just been released. On listener-supported public radio, this is Scenic Roots Talking Writing.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.